cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine, plus global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. We know that everyone is still talking about Fed Chief Jay Powell's comments this past week, signaling the Fed will slow the pace of interest rate increases next month, yet stressing the need for rates to keep rising for some time to beat inflation. No doubt about it, Tim. It was top of mind.
Also top of mind, Carol, protests in China, Apple's exposure to that, and a recent conversation that we had with Kathy Wood. She, of course, is the founder, CEO, and CIO of ARK Invest, who covered everything from the collapse of FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried to Elon, Tesla, and Twitter. We even talked about General Motors, a stock that she's been buying. The full in-depth conversation in our second hour.
All of that to come. We begin with the chaos in the place known as iPhone City. We are following the protests over the COVID zero lockdown policies in China that may be easing, but time will tell. Related to all of that, a Bloomberg exclusive. It's in the tech section of the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week.
It's about Apple's reliance on China and how it's growing perilous because of the chaos in the world's second largest economy, in a country that churns out tons of Apple products.
We bring in Joshua Brustein. He's technology editor at Bloomberg Business Week. He joined us along with the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber.
Where Apple gets its iPhones predominantly has been from Foxconn facilities in China. And with the COVID zero situation in China and sort of how the country and company have responded, Foxconn, to the circumstances, it's really led this to be a white hot situation. Josh, what transpired that and what were you guys watching as you started to pull this story together?
Yeah, the largest iPhone production facility, known as iPhone City, is in Changzhou, China. About 80% of the latest iPhone 14 models are produced there. And since October, they have been experiencing a COVID outbreak within the plant. This is an enormous place. About 200,000 people work there. And Foxconn, which runs the facility, attempted to lock the plant down, isolate workers who may have COVID, and try to keep the outbreak from spreading. The problem was they weren't really prepared to handle this, and workers were complaining of unsanitary conditions, of being held in places where they didn't have access to adequate food. Hundreds of workers left the plant in October, and there were some violent protests from workers who were protesting that they were not going to get paid if they didn't stay through a certain amount of time.
You know, and Josh, you described the dormitory sort of pretty awful conditions during this lockdown, but these are pretty coveted jobs in China, are they not?
Yeah, absolutely. There were workers who were leaving jobs that it was surprising because people get these jobs and they're known as good jobs. What's happened over the recent past has been that the COVID situation has really changed the way that this production facility operates, and people thought they had something good and now feel like they're being really mistreated.
I feel like the eyes are on Apple right now and watching what they are doing, and we have seen them, you know, begin to branch out. How does you and your team kind of think about what's going on with Apple specifically and what it means more broadly?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you want to look at a situation for a company that kind of represents something larger, you have the world's most valuable company. It makes an enormous amount of phones in China, and what you've seen Apple do is look to diversify. Foxconn, its main manufacturing partner, is moving to other countries, to India, Vietnam. So you see it looking for alternatives. If things aren't going to be, if they can't count on China, they need to know where else they can get phones from.
So what's the status now, Josh? It sounds like it's just chaos there. Are they actually still, are the assembly lines still working? Or is it sort of in a frozen while all this plays out?
Yeah, so the facility is still working. There are clearly disruptions. We've reported that someone familiar with the operation says there could be a production shortfall of close to 6 million iPhone Pro units this year. The thought is that maybe they could recover that next year, but these are serious production interruptions. And Apple has already been dealing with this even before the acute problem of the last couple of weeks.
Josh, some of the reporting was incredible because of how specific and inside the operations and the protests we were able to get. What stood out to you as you worked on the story?
I think it was really interesting to hear from some of the workers who were there. The story that we're publishing focuses on one worker who had been making phones for a decade, finally got fed up in October and left, went home, was lured back by more money, and immediately was actually in a quarantine period when these protests broke out last week, and then decided, you know, I can't stay here. Like, I came back. I'm going to go find a job at a different place. As he said, other people are hiring.
Well, you talk about, you know, these workers or the team talks about workers in isolation. There's no food. There's trash piling up. I mean, these are sounds like pretty horrible conditions.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that what you're seeing is a breaking point. I mean, at one point we describe they built barriers between the dormitories and the production facilities so that people basically couldn't stray or run away, basically, in between home and the job. And I don't know, that's pretty dystopian.
Feels a little bit like a prison.
Absolutely.
Hey, Josh, just long term here, no doubt Foxconn has and Apple have this long-standing relationship with China, but what other options does Apple and Foxconn potentially have in the long term?
So Foxconn is already making more iPhone 14 models in India, more than any previous generation, and it's expanded into Vietnam and Thailand as well. And I think that's a sign of how much Chinese policies are potentially hurting China itself. At the same time, Apple's spent decades building up this production capability, and it's not like it can just turn off this switch and turn one on somewhere else. If it really wants to reduce its reliance on China, it's going to be a long-term project.
That was Joshua Brustein. He's technology editor for the magazine. Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber with us there as well. Mike Regan's sticking around for our next segment.
Coming up after the break, we examine the broader implications of the Chinese COVID response that has put tens of millions of people on the brink.
You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Hard to miss the videos and pictures and stories about the protests that have erupted over the past week or so across China as its populace rails against the country's COVID zero strategy.
We've got the perfect voice to help explain what's happening in the People's Republic and what it means for President Xi Jinping, who's just a few weeks removed from cementing his rule at the 20th National Congress of the Chinese Communist Party.
Andy Brown is former editorial director at Bloomberg New Economy. He spent three decades in Asia as both China editor and columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Andy now leads the China Hub as a partner over at Brunswick Group. That's a critical issues advisory firm. He joined me and Bloomberg Markets senior editor Mike Regan last Monday.
I think it is the beginning of the end of COVID zero. And it is going to be, I fear, a messy, chaotic, and deadly unwinding of an irrational, poorly conceived and disastrously executed policy that has Xi Jinping's name all over it. He owns it. And he owns the public outrage that led to this, to these street protests and campus protests all over China over the weekend.
So a mistake by Xi?
Look, it's an indictment of Xi himself, okay, but it's also an indictment of the system that he set up. And it is a top-down, heavy-handed, personalized system, inflexible, ideological, highly politicized, at times brutal, and the system failed, and it's failed catastrophically. And, you know, the irony is that it has triggered precisely the thing that Xi Jinping most fears. So, you know, for the first
meaning
time...
protest, right?
Well, it's protest, but the type of protest. Okay. So, you know, there are protests in China occur all the time, okay? But they're almost always localized, single-issue protests. You know, workers aren't getting paid in a factory or in a rural area. You know, some government-connected business has grabbed your land. A lot of protests. But they're never networked, right? And they're very easily contained. These are nationwide protests that bring together disparate groups of people, poor people, rich people, students, workers, together for a common cause, and that is to defeat COVID zero, which has led to enormous amounts of frustration within the population. And the trigger for this was a fire in Urumqi in an apartment block that killed at least 10 people, including, we see the picture of this lovely Uyghur lady and her children. And the suspicion was that they had got trapped in their apartment by COVID restrictions. So fire exits being blocked or, you know, and these concrete barriers that get placed around blocks so the fire trucks couldn't get in and extinguish the blaze. And this triggered something very deep, very emotional. That lady was everybody's mother, everybody's sister, you know, everybody's wife. Those children could have been my kids because, you know, you've got 400 million people in China now living under some kind of a lockdown, many of those in precisely those conditions. You know, their front doors have been welded closed because they can't get out, and people live in fear and have been living in fear now for a long time. And so, you know, this fire just triggered this swelling sort of surge of anger right across the country. And it was so big, it wasn't, you know, how clever they are and how you know, efficient they are at blocking discussion on social media. This outbreak, a burst, was just so passionate that they couldn't contain it. Xi Jinping has no good options here, okay? He only has tough decisions, difficult trade-offs. So I'm pretty sure that with every fiber of his body, he wants to crack down, okay? I mean, he is haunted by the collapse of the Soviet Union, which, you know, he blames. They lost their ideology, abandoned Stalin, repudiated Stalin, but they lost controls of the levers of power. They compromised, you know, glasnost and perestroika. He's absolutely determined that that is not going to happen in China. So he doesn't want his policy, you know, his signature policy to be derailed, to be challenged by street protests. And I'm pretty sure that they're already now, you know, going after some of these leaders of the protest. But here's the thing, the more, you know, if he cracks down violently, you know, he could provoke an even bigger social explosion. People have had enough. I mean, they're really up to here with zero COVID. Now, on the other hand, if he opens up and opens up too quickly, he risks an explosion in cases and mass death. You know, even under the most optimistic scenarios, if they opened up like Taiwan did or like Singapore did, you know, because of the infectiousness of Omicron, you know, and the vulnerabilities that you have in and even a highly vaccinated society, you're still going to get, you know, a million or more deaths. Now, that's dynamite. for Xi Jinping, you know, the Americans lost a million, the Europeans lost a million. This proves, you know, the decadence and incompetence and the corruption of their system, their careless system. But we in China have a superior system. You know, very few people died outside of the original outbreak. So he's got to be very, very careful. But you know, look, this, you know, the real problem here is that there has been a staggering failure. And it is the failure to build defenses against Omicron that, you know, they've been so fixated on zero COVID, that they haven't invested in ICU beds, in trained specialist medical staff. But most importantly, they haven't adequately vaccinated their elderly population. You know, so, and of course, they have no natural immunity now.
Andy, do you think if China had accepted the Western vaccines, the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, would it be a whole different scenario here? Would they be able to open a lot less risky than they are now?
You know, I think people exaggerate this point. Look, it's baffling, right, why they didn't take mRNA vaccine. It's the best in class vaccine, but it's not the game changer that people say it might be. Chinese vaccines are okay. They're fine, right? They do a fine job. They prevent serious illness, they prevent death, but that's if you have your three-dose regimen, right? You get your two vaccines and your booster. The problem that they have is that they haven't insisted that their elderly get vaccinated.
That was Andy Brown. He's a partner at Brunswick Group and a former colleague of ours here at Bloomberg, where he was editorial director at Bloomberg New Economy. Mike Regan will be back a bit later in the program.
Meantime, we've seen more protests flare up in various parts of China, even amid optimism that China may ease off some of its COVID zero policies, including a vow to speed up COVID shots for the elderly.
Still ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, our cover story sheds light on a potentially deadly game being played by some young American users of the wildly popular Chinese-owned social media platform, TikTok. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive. When bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring. When you have the right foundation, it starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
Time now for this week's cover story, also a Bloomberg Big Take from the past week. This one is heart-wrenching and disturbing. It's in the latest issue of Bloomberg Business Week. It's on how TikTok's viral challenges, specifically the so-called blackout challenge, are luring young users to their deaths.
Bloomberg investigative reporter Olivia Carville reveals how the company behind the most popular app in the U.S. is responding to these horrifying cases and the consistent failure of the platform's age verification mechanisms. Olivia and Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joe Weber join us with more.
This is one of these things that everyone just assumes, you know, the kids are not going to find themselves in places that they're not supposed to be, and just truly scary some of these corners can become. Olivia, bring us into how you went about reporting this story, because it really involves some tragic elements.
Yeah, it does. I started reporting this piece by trying to get a sense of what happens inside TikTok after a child dies participating in an online challenge, and maybe there's been a headline and some local news reports connecting TikTok to that death. How does the company respond, and what happens internally? And the way to answer that question was to try and build sources on their trust and safety team. This is the team that is built within TikTok to handle the worst case scenarios. These are the fixers of the internet, the people who come in and clean up the mess, protect the company's reputation, but also try and protect users. And I spoke to more than 24 current and former trust and safety insiders to get a sense of what happens at TikTok. And that's how we were able to tell the story, is really through the lens of that trust and safety team.
Your piece starts out with just the tragic story of Ariane Arroyo. Can you share her story and what her family has gone through?
Ariane was a 9-year-old girl. She lived down in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and she loved TikTok. You know, this is the most popular app in the world, and it is hard to deny the success of this company. 70% of teenagers in America are using TikTok, and they're using it more than all of the other apps out there, Facebook, Snapchat, Twitter. So Ariane, like most kids, fell in love with TikTok. And she was using the platform on a daily basis, and she really enjoyed participating in the trending challenges. In February of last year, she attempted the blackout challenge, which is where children try and choke themselves with household objects until they black out, and then film the adrenaline rush or the high they get regaining consciousness. But at the age of 9, Ariane unfortunately was unable to save herself. She'd choked herself with a metal dog leash and she tragically died.
So Olivia, obviously TikTok is aware that there's a challenge here and that these have happened. There's been lawsuits. What does the company have to say about it, and what's their official response, and then what are others saying about that response?
Yeah, I mean, these dangerous challenges bounce across platforms. They exist on TikTok, but they exist on all the others as well. And users actually try and sidestep safety restrictions by doing things like misspelling keywords. So rather than writing blackout challenge, which has been banned on TikTok, they'll write blackout with a zero and try and get around the artificial intelligence or the systems that have been set up to try and protect kids. So TikTok really doesn't want this content on its platform. It's done what it can to train its moderators to take down any content relating to the blackout challenge. And it also prevents anyone from being able to search for blackout challenge related content in the app. And it set those safety restrictions in place at the start of last year, after the first 10-year-old girl died attempting this particular challenge. But unfortunately, kids are smart and they know how to get around these safety restrictions, and they're doing that. And that means that the challenge is continuing to spread across social media platforms. And the most recent cases that we could find of deaths associated to the blackout challenge was August of this year. So despite all of those safety features being implemented, the deaths have kept happening.
Where do you think we need to go from here to get on top of this?
Well, that question of age verification is like the elephant in the room. This is one of the hardest things for these social media platforms to do. How can you tell the exact age of the person who is on the app, you know, using that device?
Yeah.
And don't forget that children's content is allowed on TikTok. You can film your children or your siblings who are under the age of 13 and post about it. Every social media platform, in the US at least, has a rule that says you have to be over the age of 13 to use the product. You know, they call it within the industry the age gate. And it's very hard to enforce that. So these companies are trying to find ways around it, but this is one of the biggest challenges that social media platforms face.
That was Bloomberg investigative reporter Olivia Carville and Bloomberg Businessweek editor Jill Weber on this week's cover story. Just head to Bloomberg.com or check it out on the terminal for a full-length video feature on this piece. Hard to stomach, but I gotta say, important for the parents of young kids to see and know about.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up next, we shift gears and take a look at a key area of the consumer economy, the travel and hospitality sector.
Then we get a post-Thanksgiving pulse check with Priceline CEO Brett Keller. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Just over 2.5 million passengers passed through U.S. airport checkpoints last Sunday, according to Transportation Security Administration data. We're talking about the TSA. That's the most in a single day since before the COVID-19 pandemic, up about 4.5% from the same day last year, again, according to the TSA.
Still, the one-day tally fell about 11% shy of the same figure in 2019. That's when 2.88 million travelers were screened. With a look at the travel scene this past weekend and what may be to come, Bloomberg Markets senior editor Mike Regan and Carol spoke with Priceline CEO Brett Keller on the heels of a cross-country flight to the East Coast.
The plane was completely packed, you know, a little bit of a delay coming into New York. But overall, you know, the Thanksgiving period of travel across the country was very smooth.
You know, Brett, obviously inflation's been the hot topic all year. I'm wondering what you're seeing as far as prices in the travel, hotel, airfare, that sort of thing. Are they rising as much as, you know, CPI would suggest, something like 7-8%?
Actually, a little hotter than that. Depends on, you know, whether you're booking a flight or booking a hotel, but they're both up. On the hotel side, you know, prices up 7-8% versus where they were a year ago today, so a little less than the CPI. But when you look at flights, and they're closer to 15-20%, especially if you're flying overseas. So with the cost of jet fuel, you know, really up 50% where it was a year ago, that's pushing prices higher along with labor costs. And consumers seem to be shaking off those higher prices. They continue to prioritize travel over other purchases and are really hitting the road. So here at Priceline, you know, we're really seeing good, healthy travel demand. October actually accelerated from where it was in August and September. And as we look into next year, patterns seem to be holding up, at least so far.
So are we back at 2019 levels based on what you're seeing off your platform, Brett?
Yeah, we're very close on the hotel front. If you just look at industry data broadly for the hotel category, you know, their occupancy rates are just about where they were in 2019, maybe a percentage point below, but very healthy. On the flight side, even higher, in the 90s in terms of, you know, seat capacity utilization. So things look pretty good in the industry right now. And, you know, consumers no longer have any COVID concerns, especially here in domestic travel in the U.S. And we're seeing a really strong demand into Europe and now starting into Asia as they've lifted restrictions there.
Let me just to follow on that. So I am always curious, Brett, on a platform like yours, I mean, how much visibility do you have looking out? Is it a couple of months? Is it 6 months? Is it 12 months? What kind of visibility do you have in terms of what the environment might be for travel heading into 2023?
Sure. Well, the average booking window for a consumer booking, you know, out into the future is usually pretty close in, 2-3 to 4 weeks. That's really where most of the bookings happen. But we do see, you know, well into the future, people will book out 2, 3, and 4 months for certain types of vacations. And so that's a good proxy for what we're seeing. And so far, that data looks pretty good. Things are still relatively healthy as we look into the future, into first quarter of next year. So, you know, demand, again, appears to be holding up, and we'll see where it goes from there. But so far, we're happy with how things are playing out in the travel space.
You know, Brett, I think probably a lot of listeners hit your site looking for a deal, of course. You know, are any tips on how to save a few bucks in this holiday season, considering prices of everything are higher? Are there any sort of tricks of the trade you could share with us?
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, this is why Priceline was founded, you know, 25 years ago, was to help consumers navigate a very complex space and find savings. So when you think about ways to save money today in this really high-priced environment, one is you really need to avoid these high peak travel dates if your schedule allows. And more consumers are able to do that now. So, for example, with the upcoming holidays, try your best not to fly on the 23rd and the 27th, right before and right after a Christmas holiday or the day after New Year's Day. Really try and push that out a couple of days. You can save 15-20% because they really optimally price for those dates from the airline side. A second way is on a site like Priceline, you can book with mixed carriers. So you can fly out on one airline, fly back on another. That can typically deliver you anywhere from 5-10% off of what you would pay if you flew out and back on the same carrier. So by mixing and matching carriers, you can save money. And a third is to package, right? And bundle your bookings together. So if you're going to book a hotel and a flight, bundle those together. You will save money because we have access to specially negotiated rates that can only be used in that bundled experience. And that does deliver real value up to, you know, a couple of $100 a trip when you really are thoughtful about destinations and how you book those together.
You guys do have lots of data. You can see in real time, like, what's interesting to people. What are the most popular flights that people are booking right now?
Well, you know, coming out of 2021, consumers really stayed close to home, and many of them were not really even leaving the country. And so we've seen big markets really start to open up this year, especially for Christmas and New Year's. So New York, Atlanta, Las Vegas, LA, all very, very top of the charts right now. Also Orlando, that's always been a number one or number two market for us in particular, but really for the country. And it continues to be a top market for consumers. But what we're seeing a lot more the second half of 2022 is people are leaving the U.S. to travel overseas. And when you look at where they're going in Europe, obviously London is a big market, but they're also heading into many other interesting destinations there, and a few now moving into Asia. But really, for the holiday period, warm destinations are at the top of the list. Locations like Cancun, Jamaica, Dominican Republic are very, very appealing to consumers just looking to get a break and get some sunshine.
A colleague of ours here said, yep, we just came back from Jamaica. And so, yeah, people, Mike, are out and about, and they're getting out of the U.S.
I'll take any of those destinations, I think, at this point.
Yes, yes, and yes.
Hot sand, a golf course, a swimming pool, one of those drinks with the umbrella. But Brett, you know, it's such an unusual economic environment that we're in right now. We have high inflation, but super low unemployment. Everyone's worried about a recession. I'm wondering which of those variables matter the most to your business. You know, is it unemployment? Is it GDP? Is it inflation? Is, you know, my guess is unemployment is probably the main thing that would sort of be a headwind to travel. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, I think that's a fair assumption. I've been in the industry for over 25 years. You know, we went through this back in 08, and travel is a very resilient category. People, you know, seem to prioritize that. They always want to have that opportunity to visit family, to take a break. And so, you know, if you're unemployed, obviously that makes it very, very challenging to pull together the dollars that's required to take a trip like this. But what people will typically do if they're constrained is they'll start to, you know, modify how they travel. They may drive instead of fly. They may, you know, drop down a star category. They'll find ways to save money but still take that trip. And we're not necessarily seeing that trade down happen yet, but certainly that's what consumers may, you know, end up doing if they're really pressed for cash.
Brett, we spend, I feel like, every day in and out here at Bloomberg because of the upcoming Fed meeting, because of the Fed conversations, because of Jay Powell speaking this week. We talk about, you know, the prospect of a recession, whether it will be shallow, whether it will be deep, whether the Fed will overdo it. What's the conversations, constructive conversations you guys are having at Priceline when it comes to the economic outlook and the possibility of a recession?
Sure. Well, that's obviously on everyone's mind here as well as we read the news and everything that's going on in the category.
Right.
What's interesting, though, is so far the hotel chains, the major airlines, they are all signaling good, strong, healthy demand for their product. And a lot of that obviously is because of consumers not being able to travel for really a good year and a half. And so that's propelling travel forward. And, you know, when you think about what consumers are looking to do with whatever extra cash they have, they are prioritizing this now over really commodities. So, you know, as we think about a recession, we're thinking, yeah, this could be obviously harmful to the industry longer term, but we just don't see that. And historically, when you look back to 08, it weathered that very, very well as well. So we're very optimistic about the next couple of years, even in the face of what could be, you know, a recession. But, you know, you can't predict the future anymore. It's becoming a bit too challenging.
You know, Brett, quickly, I was looking at some of the notes you sent us before the show, and cruises, the price you gave, the low price for a cruise ship per night made my eyes pop out. Is that a typo? $70 a night you can go on a cruise for?
No, that's absolutely an accurate figure.
Wow.
In fact, you know, that's one of, and most people don't know this, it is one of the most cost-effective vacations there are, because it typically includes obviously food and beverage as well. So you bring that together, it's a really nice vacation. Now you have to get yourself to a cruise port, but there are ways to either drive there or find a cheap flight to get you there to then get you onto that cruise line. And now, you know, the cruise lines obviously had a tough time through COVID and continue to have a lot of excess capacity, more so than many of the other travel categories.
Right.
So they're really rolling out the credits and other things to get you onto those ships.
That was Priceline CEO Brett Keller with me and Mike Regan. Priceline, by the way, a subsidiary of the publicly held Booking Holdings. And that wraps up our first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Ahead in our next hour, we go in depth with Kathy Wood of ARK Invest on everything from Elon Musk to this year's Fed policy and the latest on crypto deep freeze brought on by the collapse of FTX.
A great voice for so much going on right now.
Yes, a lot of people have lost a lot of money around the crypto asset ecosystem losing value here. But if we're right on the underlying technology and the underlying roles that Bitcoin and Ether, Ethereum are going to play in this new world, then I think we're going to recover pretty quickly.
Stick around. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine, plus global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including our comprehensive interview with Cathie Wood of ARK Invest. Everything from Elon Musk and Twitter and Tesla to the FTX implosion.
First up this hour, the crypto crash from a different angle. The Business Week team has a story online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and on the terminal about how the digital asset turmoil is actually helping couples rekindle their relationships.
That's an angle I didn't see. Bloomberg Markets senior editor Mike Regan, and I got more from Business Week contributor Joel Stein, as well as the Markets and finance editor for the magazine, Pat Regnier.
I think all of us who've spent any time reporting on crypto got to know people for whom crypto became kind of a defining part of their lives. I mean, a lot of the people listening to this are just ordinary finance workaholics who have a hard enough time sort of paying attention to this stuff, when the markets are open. But crypto has this quality of never being closed, even on the weekends, and bringing a lot of things outside of people's peripheral vision. And I think a lot of people have had a hard time kind of emotionally managing that. And the side effect of that is that it's hard on people's relationships. But Joel, tell me how you kind of came on to this. These were some people you knew.
Yeah, it's my friend Igor Hiller, who's in the piece. And he was the guy I always called when I ever got assigned a crypto story to ask him like the basics of like what the hell this was all about. And he was over for dinner with his longtime girlfriend. They've been together for like 4 years, and they told us a kind of like what started out as a really funny story and turned really kind of sad and serious, where they almost broke up.
Wow.
Because he wasn't paying any attention to the relationship because he was so obsessed with his crypto buds and hanging out with them and just checking his phone constantly and waiting for NFT drops and just like, you know, degenerate gambler. Maybe you'd call it degenning when he went into these kind of phases. And she kind of gave him an ultimatum that it was either crypto or her.
But, you know, Joel, you mentioned those NFT drops, and I get the impression reading this that NFTs almost really worsened this situation because you're stuck there waiting for these things to drop and they can be delayed. Did you get that sense too that, you know, the addiction was almost worse when it came to NFTs, both because of the time consumption and also sort of the potential upside in those as an investment, at least for a hot minute there?
For a hot minute, NFTs were, but throughout the entire, you know, crypto cycle, there was always a different thing that could occupy you 24 hours a day because crypto markets don't close. So during the DeFi farming phase, there was always some new farm that was opening up that you had to get involved and get their coin real quick. Or there'd be a coin drop, right? Like people were creating new coins all the time. And Elon Musk or someone else would tell you that this was a hot coin you had to get, and you had to get it, you know, when it was minted. So I don't think it was just NFTs. There was always some new craze that you had to get involved in. And, you know, maybe you had to simp some star in order to get involved in that, you know, in that Discord channel and buy, I guess those are often NFTs. But yeah, there was always a new craze. And even if you kept up with one of them, there'd be a new one that popped up.
Pat, come on back in on the conversation.
Sure. Yeah, you know, one of the things I'm thinking about a lot with all of the really serious stuff happening now is that, you know, we've learned that markets can grow up faster than you can teach yourself how to think about them. Mm-hmm. And I think also faster than you can teach yourself how to emotionally handle them. You know, in the last 2 years in crypto, even for people who aren't investing in it, it's been something that has moved so fast that it just keeps you kind of like mentally and emotionally agitated. You know, I mean, I also kind of want to talk a little bit about sort of, you know, the people who are the partners in these situations and Joel, sort of like what they felt like they had to do to kind of get a hold of their relationships and really like bring their partners back from the brink.
Yeah, in almost every case, there was a guy, and it was almost always a young. It was always, in fact, we were looking all around. All we could find was young men, and the numbers in polls and kind of play this out. But it's a bunch of young men, and they get so wrapped up in this, and they think it's going to be a life changing moment that they can't miss out on. It's all FOMO, and that there's going to be generational wealth created for their grandchildren if they just stick to this one thing. And they all kind of were able to get their spouse, or more like their girlfriend, involved to an extent, but not as much as they would have liked. And then their relationships started to wither because they were so devoted to this one thing.
Yeah, Joel, I wonder if, you know, if these guys really are creating wealth through this, if that sort of changes the equation with the wives and girlfriends a little bit. Were any of these guys actually, you know, doing well with their trading enough to, you know, sort of get the day pass from their wives and girlfriends?
Sure. I mean, some of these guys, you know, on an exciting day could make $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, the guys I was talking to at least. And that goes a little, you know, a long way in convincing your girlfriend that it's okay you didn't go out with her this weekend. But, you know, those days were few and far between, especially as the market started to dry up at the beginning of this year. But in a lot of these cases, eventually, either because of the crash or because of ultimatums, the boyfriends somewhat came around and people were able to resolve their relationships in a lot of the cases where I talked to people.
So, Joel, what do you think happens if the crypto market takes off again? Are these guys incorrigible, or have they learned their lesson? How do you see it playing out?
I mean, do you know any gamblers? They tend to be incorrigible. You know, I think there's hope that lessons were learned, but I think it's a very powerful draw.
That was Bloomberg Businessweek contributor Joel Stein with markets and finance editor Pat Regnier. Mike Regan taking part there as well.
That angle, right? Caught us by surprise.
Didn't see that coming.
Yeah, exactly. All right, you're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek. Coming up, we go the distance with ARK Invest founder and CEO Cathie Wood on FTX, SBF, and Elon Musk's latest venture.
I think opening up the algorithms, which we think he will do, and taking away the kind of human-driven censorship and allowing the transparency of the algorithms that they do put out there, I think it's going to be very healthy.
This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Whatever happened, whatever it happened, I had a duty. I had a duty to all of our stakeholders, to our customers, our creditors. I had a duty to our employees, to our investors, and to the regulators of the world to do right by them, to make sure the right things happened at the company. And clearly, I didn't do a good job of that. I was shocked by what happened this month.
That was FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried from the New York Times DealBook Summit on Wednesday, trying to explain the collapse of his crypto exchange and trading firm Alameda. Certainly a lot of questions, though, still to be answered.
All right, for the rest of this hour, speaking of questions and views when it comes to SBF and Alameda and FTX, for the rest of this hour, we've got a well-known investor to address many of the big stories of the day, including that latest crypto meltdown. We're also going to talk about Elon, Twitter, Elon and Tesla, and so much more.
Okay, we're talking about Cathie Wood. She's the founder, CEO, and CIO of ARK Invest, who joined us prior to Thanksgiving. This was in the wake of SBF's crypto empire just going belly up. And despite the deepest freeze yet in the crypto winter, Cathie Wood is staying the course.
It's been a very challenging few, I should say 20 months, but we're looking at our portfolios right now, and we are back to where we were in terms of calling them deep value portfolios if you give us a five-year investment time horizon. I mean, we're seeing incredible values for the kinds of growth, that our portfolios are going to deliver.
You know where I want to go. I got to talk to you about the crypto space. You, it's a world you know really well. We think about the FTX collapse, the coming undone of Sam Bankman-Fried. You know, you have been buying into some of the different names in the crypto space: Coinbase, Grayscale, Bitcoin Trust. Why should investors trust crypto? Why do you trust crypto at this point?
If you look at the blockchains, let's use the Bitcoin blockchain and Ethereum, what you'll find is they have the infrastructure, the technology has not skipped a beat throughout this entire crisis. In fact, the hash rate, Bitcoin's hash rate is at an all-time high, and that is a real indication of the security of the network. On Ethereum, we're seeing the total value staked at $24 billion. That is an all-time high. So we think the infrastructure is working beautifully. As far as Coinbase, this is an onshore regulated company and wanting to help shape regulations. Brian Armstrong, the CEO, and Alicia, CFO, have been leaning into what's going on right now and saying, okay, regulators, we need more clarity in order to protect investors. Those who wanted to get involved with certain types of crypto were forced offshore, and look at what's happened. So I think that Coinbase is going to come out here looking very, very strong. It just lost a very big competitor in FTX.
Well, what is the market missing, though? Because, you know, that could be one narrative, Cathie, but at the same time, we haven't exactly seen shares of Coinbase rally since FTX's collapse. Do you think you that represents potentially broader concern about just people's interest in crypto following FTX's collapse?
No, I think it's more fear. I think many people say we don't know what we don't know. So what we do is we step back, put a little perspective into the situation here. And what do we have? So the entire crypto asset ecosystem is an $800 billion ecosystem. Apple is three times larger in terms of market cap. So that's some perspective. Many people are saying, is this another Lehman? Could this be could we see the domino effect here? I've just given you one reason why. The banking system back in 08, 09, trillions and trillions of dollars, and it was the global banking system. Right now we have, it seems, from FTX, $5 to $10 billion in creditors as FTX has filed bankruptcy, they will be making claims. If you look at Lehman, that was $1.2 trillion in claims. So again, just trying to put perspective, this is fraud. This is Madoff. Madoff was $64 billion in claims. Again, FTX, $5 to $10 billion. Now, I know that crypto assets are, they attract a lot of attention. This is the three revolutions we talk about all the time, a new monetary system in terms of the first global, private, meaning not government controlled, digital, rules-based monetary system. That's Bitcoin, a very big idea. DeFi is a very big idea. And while that has been thrown into question in terms of, you know, shifting from one exchange to another, we've had a lot of shifting around. But I think DeFi, well, in terms of taking the middlemen out of financial services and making the ecosystem much more transparent with much less counterparty risk, is going to take off. It will continue to move forward, we believe.
Kathy, I think one of the things we're trying to figure out is how long that we think the industry will be feeling the ramifications of FTX. I mean, one thing we've learned, right, with SBF and FTX is what we didn't know. So how long do you think this goes on? Because you obviously have faith in it. You've been buying into it, and you think this is a good entry point at this point, whether it's Grayscale, whether it's Coinbase. But how long do you think we continue to feel the effect? And do you think there's more contagion to be felt?
Well, we always look for the whale in a situation like this. And if there was a whale out there, it was FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried, you know, king of the hill. So I think we found the whale. And, you know, I'm sure there's going to be more fallout, but mm-hmm. we see how big the whale is. And yes, a lot of people have lost a lot of money around the crypto asset ecosystem losing value here. But if we're right on the underlying technology and the underlying roles that Bitcoin and Ether, Ethereum are going to play in this new world, then I think we're going to recover pretty quickly.
More ahead with ARK Invest founder, CEO, and CIO Kathy Wood. Coming up, she's going to tell us more about her one-on-one meeting with Sam Bankman-Fried. That was in a different time, when FTX was still flying high.
Plus, why she thinks SBF is a fraud on the level of Bernie Madoff. And we do want to emphasize to listeners that regulators are still probing exactly what happened with FTX, and Bloomberg News will continue to provide new information as the case unfolds.
I think the thing that is shocking is how many people were very close to him, and one would have presumed looked at all of the documents and got a sense of the books.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
More now from our recent conversation with ARK Invest founder, CEO, and CIO Kathy Wood. When we spoke with her on November 22nd, the scope of the FTX bankruptcy probe was and still is coming into focus.
And even since our conversation with her, Carol, we've seen several other dominoes fall just in the last few days. That does, of course, include BlockFi recently filing for bankruptcy. Here we ask about Sam Bankman-Fried, though. And Kathy Wood, she did not mince words here. Again, we do remind you that investigators are still looking into whether he committed a crime, and if so, on what scale?
More like Madoff.
More like Madoff.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Well, give us an understanding of what your interactions were with Sam Bankman-Fried before this fallout. And have you spoken to him? Because I know you were at Crypto Bahamas, along with many other people, earlier this year, the FTX Salt Conference.
Yes, I had a Zoom. My team and I had a Zoom with Sam before that conference. I think they wanted to have us represented at the conference. But other than that one phone call, just to set up, I have never talked to him. And by the end of the phone call, seemed to be distracted by whatever else he was doing. So that was my one exposure to him. And, you know, I think the thing that is shocking is how many people were very close to him. And one would have presumed looked at all of the documents and got a sense of the books. The fact that so many people were completely fooled is quite shocking. You know, I think he had this aura around him or something that caused people to ask fewer questions than might otherwise have been the case. It's very hard to understand.
Do you worry at all about, as you buy into Grayscale, Kathy, you know, the whole world of the digital currency group and Barry Silbert's company? I mean, the various connections that kind of go back to FTX. Are you at all worried about a liquidation or anything?
We know that the Grayscale investment trusts are the most valuable part of that company right now. We think they're going to try and hold on to that, if nothing else. Now, one of the things that we know that Grayscale and Michael Sonnenschein at Grayscale wanted was to convert this trust into an ETF.
Right.
I think what's happened with the fallout here might increase the probability that a Bitcoin ETF will be approved. I'm not saying immediately, but we know that, and even the newest SEC commissioner, Jaime Lizarraga, I think is his name, has come out and said, we need as regulators to focus on decentralization and transparency. What is the most decentralized and transparent crypto asset in the world? It is Bitcoin. And yet retail investors do not have easy access through a liquid asset like an ETF, which honestly, I don't understand given that they approved a Bitcoin futures fund. So I think it might increase the odds. We shall see.
Well, and some have been wondering whether or not you're playing the arbitrage with GBTC right now. You know, is it that because of the trust deep discount at this point? Is that the thinking for you to kind of be moving more money into this name?
Well, it is one of the few securities. We have to own securities in ETFs. So it is one of the few securities we can buy. And yes, it's at a very big discount. So it is more attractive. Bitcoin, if they were to even liquidate it, you know, we've got such a big discount relative to Bitcoin. We don't think they're going to. This is the most valuable property. I think they're going to hang on to it. And I think over time, the discount will close. Don't know if it's because of a conversion to a Bitcoin ETF. I'm sure the regulators will take a very close look at DCG and the Grayscale Bitcoin Investment Trust. But we do know this is a grantor trust, highly regulated.
Kathy, we've talked Coinbase, we've talked GBTC. Are there any other opportunities in crypto that you see right now in the wake of FTX's collapse as prices have been beaten up?
Well, again, for our ETFs, as you mentioned, own Coinbase. We also own Square. And it is interesting that Jack Dorsey has chosen the most transparent, most decentralized crypto asset to center Block's crypto exposure to. And I realize he's trying to, from a developer community point of view, leave them on their own. But we do think Bitcoin, and you can see through the behavior of the infrastructure, hasn't skipped a beat, more secure than it was yesterday, the day before, and the day before. So I have a feeling this is going to elevate Bitcoin in the eyes of not only the crypto world, but the investment world at large. And I have a feeling it's going to have more running room through the rest of the world. We think they're going to be very successful.
That, of course, is Kathy Wood of ARK Invest. We'll wrap up getting her thoughts on one of her longtime investments.
Yeah, safe to say, Tim, she is the original Tesla bull. Yeah. We asked Kathy Wood on where Elon, his EV giant, and yes, Twitter, go from here.
This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Heading for home on this weekend broadcast and bringing you our deep dive with Kathy Wood of ARK Invest. We talked with her just before Thanksgiving. At the time, she reaffirmed her forecast for Bitcoin to reach $1 million per coin by 2030, though she did say the recent crypto crash could slow institutional adoption.
Of course, ARK Invest has interests that go well beyond digital assets. One of those is Elon Musk. Kathy Wood has already bet big and cashed in on Tesla. Now she's looking to do the same with Twitter, purchasing a private stake in Twitter via ARK's venture fund back in early November. The question now is whether Musk is the right person for this job, too.
We owned Twitter for quite a while, and we sold it into the rumors that Elon was going to buy it because we knew there would be a lot of controversy around that. So it moved into the 60s. I think it got to 70. And we sold there and have been watching from the sidelines. But if you look at that model longer run, it has not delivered on the promise. And I think opening up the algorithms, which we think he will do, and taking away the kind of human-driven censorship and allowing the transparency of the algorithms that they do put out there, allowing people to question them, I think is going to be very healthy. If you look at the daily average users, I think the various metrics that you can count daily, they have been going up dramatically. So I know a lot of people who, basically decided to quit Twitter because they didn't like the kind of censorship and so forth that was going on. So I actually like what he's doing.
It seems, interestingly enough, though, that a lot of brands don't like what he's doing, Kathy. And we've seen some prominent companies pull back or at least pause advertising on the platform.
The auto companies.
Of course. I mean, that makes sense if, you don't necessarily want to support the guy who owns Tesla if you're making competitive vehicles to Tesla. But bigger brands that are worried about brand safety. And I'm wondering, it doesn't seem like it's necessarily moving in the direction of increasing revenue from an advertorial perspective right now.
I do think that this is not just an advertising vehicle. In fact, that probably might diminish quite significantly in terms of its importance longer run. You'll remember that Elon started his entrepreneurial pursuits with a precursor to PayPal. So he, a very long time ago, had this idea of a digital wallet, a super app like WhatsApp in mind, and of course took a big detour into another passion of his. We know he knows a lot about this world. And I think if anyone in the U.S. can do this, I think he can. I think he'll surround himself by the right business leaders. He's not going to do this himself. Many people say, aren't you worried about Tesla? No, we're not, because of our work on electric vehicles. They are grabbing at a disproportionate share and will continue to do so of a market that we think by 2027 will account for 85 to 95% of all cars sold in the world. So that's on automatic pilot. He's now working on autonomous, which we think is going to work. In fact, I just had the pleasure of riding in a cruise car in San Francisco, an autonomous car.
A GM.
Proof of concept, a GM. Just wanted to see, wanted to check it out. And I have to tell you, I love the ride. And I know autonomous is possible because Cruise and Waymo are doing it. And we think Tesla is going to do it in a much bigger way. So that's Tesla. But on to Twitter. It really needed to be shaken up. And I
do you think he can make it be a great business and very profitable? And if so, how?
I do. Think about the amount of data that Twitter has, and it's proprietary data. And think about the combination of that and artificial intelligence. Remember, he has AI expertise and experts. I know he brought in some of his engineers, and they are going to, I think, surprise and delight, heading for a super app kind of product. And, you know, by our estimates, and you'll find this in our big ideas, I think it was 2021, the value of each customer in a digital wallet should be in the 20,000 plus range, because it's not just for financial services, it'll ultimately be for commerce. And AI is the glue that's going to pull this all together. And the data that they have, the data is the new oil. You've heard that. This is absolutely true in the case of Twitter.
Well, Kathy, I mean, the currency, Twitter as a currency, has worked really well for you. You've got 1.5 million followers on the platform. A lot of people see what you tweet. We saw eulogies being written for Twitter. It didn't end up dying, as many people thought it would. But what would happen if Twitter went away? And are you concerned about that?
This is an extremely productive social network for us. It is our most productive. And, you know, it truly is the global public town square. You know, I can write an open letter to the Fed and put it out over Twitter. Now, do I think the Fed's going to listen to me? No, I don't. But that they may listen, the Fed board members may listen to someone who might think that I have something to say, which is simply a question. Wait a minute, how can you be unanimous 75 basis points at a time? How can you be unanimous when there is so much conflicting data out there, including an inverted yield curve now at 75 basis points? That's crazy. I think we're going to look back in history and say, what were they thinking? Unanimous, commodity prices are falling. You've got excess inventories all over the place. We're seeing massive discounting. I think we're going to see deflation, and then they'll make a move in the opposite direction. But we need a steadier hand than that. So,
wait, Kathy, when do you, because you've argued this and you've put this out there in terms of Fed policy, in terms of deflation, when do you think it will come?
I think we're seeing it. Okay. I think if you look at a lot of commodity prices, not only are they down 30 to some of them 80% from their peaks, they're down on a year over year basis. In fact, oil itself is almost down on a year over year basis now. The big pushbacks on this call we get are wages and rents. We're seeing rent inflation reverse quite suddenly and dramatically. What I think we will look back in history and say, this inflation shock was the function of a supply shock caused by COVID, supply chain problems afterwards, and even more problems after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. If I can just take 1 second, I would like to give an analogy to the late 19-teens. We were in the middle of the massive innovation the history of the world had seen, telephone, electricity, and automobile, all at the same time. But we had World War I, and we had the Spanish flu. Sound familiar? Now, that was much worse than what we've gone through. We've gone through nothing like that. But there were massive supply chain problems back then. And inflation peaked at 24%, right, in June of 1920. And by June of 1921, it was minus 15%. So I think that our 8 to 10% inflation, which is where it was at the peak, is going to turn around, and we're going to see some very big surprises on the inflation front. And you know who agrees with us? The bond market. Look at what the bond market is doing now. 75% inverted. That's telling us that the bond market is saying recession and or big surprises on the low side of inflation expectations.
Hey,
so, and it's probably both.
Kathy, unfortunately, we only have a couple of minutes left here. One thing we did want to squeeze in, we've been talking about it in the newsroom, that AllianceBernstein is getting ready to launch actively managed disruptor ETFs. And from what I understand, you pitched them, you know, years ago. How does that make you feel? And, you know, to see from that you worked at kind of doing a very similar thing or looking to do something similar.
Yes, well, AllianceBernstein, I believe, got the first fully active, fully transparent ETF in, I think it was early, it got it was approved in early 2013. So that's when I put my hand up and said, I'll do that. And there was a belief that ETFs were not safe, or, you know, there were a lot of arguments against it.
Right.
Probably the biggest one was mutual funds, which are much more profitable, I would say. The economics there are higher than ETFs. How does it make me feel? You know, the more the merrier. I think this is a fantastic wrapper for the end consumer. It's fully liquid, unlike mutual funds. You have to wait till the end of the day. Transparent, fully transparent. That's what investors want. It is more tax effective, much more tax effective. We're seeing mutual funds that are down 30% this year,
right,
but they're slapping their investors with 35% in capital tax gains. And then finally, it's more cost effective when what you see is what you get with these fees. There aren't a bunch of hidden fees. So it's a great wrapper for the end consumer. I highly recommend it. And we're happy that they are seeing the light now.
That's Kathy Wood, ARK Invest founder, CEO, and CIO. If you missed any of the conversation, just head on over to our podcast feed.
And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. Big shout out to Bloomberg Markets Senior Editor Mike Regan for helping us out. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday starting at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
And check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find that at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
And you can also see me on Bloomberg Quick Take, available on Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Stay safe. This is Bloomberg.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Business Week, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.